I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. So have you added quinoa, kale, bone marrow, chia seeds, kimchi to your diet? Have you noticed the popularity of cupcakes, bacon, food trucks, smoked or toasted spices? And while coffee shops are everywhere now, a generation ago, you had to look far and wide for a good cup of freshly brewed coffee. Our guest, David Sacks, explores the reasons why some foods take off and others don't in his new book called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes and Fed Up with Fondue. He writes about business and food, and his writing does appear regularly in the New York Times, Bloomberg, Businessweek, Savour, The Grid, and other publications. He joins us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto, Canada, to talk about food trends and fads. And David Sacks, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
I got married in the early 1970s, and I think I got 5 fondue dishes as wedding presents. Where are they today, do you think?
I'm guessing they're either in your garage or at a garage sale recently disposed of.
So, I mean, that was the hot trend in the early 70s.
Exactly. And so, you know, trends really succeed and they live in the times that they're born in. The fondue trend grew from this, you know, Swiss traditional food to something that was popular at a couple of restaurants in New York City in the 60s to the fondue party trend and the wedding gifts that you received in abundance in the 1970s, which coincided with, you know, suburbanization and the sexual revolution. Suddenly you could make your living room in suburban Philadelphia a hotbed of sort of swinging libido, or at least, you know, shared plates and breaking down barriers between neighbors. And when that era died because of say the rise of disco and you know the end of the sexual revolution brought on by the HIV/AIDS epidemic, the forces that backed fondue up passed away as well. And also, you know, diets changing. The low-fat, low-carb trend didn't do fondue any favors.
So you're making a connection between fondue and the sexual revolution. The idea that people would share this bowl of bubbly cheese.
Yeah, you know, the pill and fondue kind of rose in concert. And listen, it's not saying that everybody who received a fondue set all of a sudden, you know, threw key parties.
Right.
But it existed within a time and a cultural milieu, as most food trends do. And so when the times change and the things we're looking for to be our edible symbols of the times change with those.
Well, the other item on the cover of your book is a big picture of a cupcake. And you really go to Sex and the City, saying that in fact, an episode in Sex and the City created this cupcake craze.
Well, I say it's 3 things. You know, it was a scene, really. It was a 20-second scene of one episode of Sex and the City in the second season. That was it. Cupcakes never really appeared again in the show, unlike Cosmopolitan Martinis, which were in every second episode.
And all those shoes, yes.
And the shoes, exactly. But, you know, there were 2 other big factors. One of them was September 11th and the return really of food trends in the comfort food realm right after that. As when times are bad, when we have recessions or times of war, times of strife, we want to return to things that are familiar and warm and filled with good memories. So, you know, right after that, you saw the rise of places serving, you know, gourmet hamburgers and mac and cheese and grilled cheese. And, you know, what could be a happier, more joyful association with the past than a cupcake?
Because that's what we had, you know, in first grade when it was our birthday, our moms would make us a plate of cupcakes to bring into our classmates.
Exactly. Hey, everyone, it's Marty's birthday today. Yay! And, you know, all of a sudden the class would be smeared in, like, chocolate. It'd just be a chaos, an absolute war zone. The third factor, which I think really differentiates something like the cupcake trend from, say, the fondue trend or muffins a decade or so previous, was the internet. You know, it was the first 21st century viral food trend. It was the trend that emerged and blew up because it happened at the same time that blogs were emerging first. So you had a whole series of cupcake blogs, baking blogs that could post recipes, post photos, post experiences and visits to cupcakeries all over the world. And then Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and Instagram, which just allowed that to happen with so much ease and so much virality, so that somebody who opened up a cupcake shop in, say, Lahore, Pakistan, mm-hmm. didn't need to fly to New York and go to Magnolia Bakery or fly to Philadelphia and go to the cupcake shop that happens to be there, taste it, learn about it, go back, attempt a recipe. They could see a photo of it. They could read a blog post of it and just go ahead and do it on their own.
I mean,
Go ahead. No. And so the cupcake trend spread very quickly and very widely as the internet grew. And as you see with current food trends, like the rise of the cronut last summer, which is really more of a seasonal fad. You know, the difference between a fad and a trend is time, basically.
Sure.
You saw it go from this one coveted item in a New York bakery to something that all the Dunkin' Donuts chains in South Korea were serving within the span of 2 months.
But everyone, it seems, is a foodie these days, or certainly has, you know, you can post your comments on Yelp, taking pictures of a meal. I've done that and sent that to friends that I think would appreciate it. I think this is a great thing, that we're more discriminating, we're more adventurous, and seems more interested in eating food than a generation or two ago, or enjoying food.
Absolutely. You know, that is something that really defines this era of food trends that we're living in. And so, you know, the virality, but also the democratic nature of food culture has made food trends more pervasive across all eaters. 3-4 decades ago, this was only something that, you know, people who had traveled to Europe and knew their wines and, you know, read James Beard and basically wore ascots talked about. Oh, I've eaten here. And,
yes.
You know, have you tried the Beaujolais yes. Nouveau? It's outstanding this year. And the rest of us just, you know, we were happy eating hot dogs and cupcakes that our moms made. But over the past decade, as the internet has risen, so too has the culture of food, the rise of the Food Network, the rise of food travel shows like Anthony Bourdain's or Andrew Zimmern's, and also the rise of chef culture, not just televised chefs like Emeril Lagasse or Ming Tsai or Mario Batali, but every city has their own crop of local celebrity chefs, you know, Michael Solomonov in Philadelphia, for
sure.
example, or even people here in Toronto who may not be known outside the city, but, you know, their faces promote all sorts of products because they are our new artists. They're the equivalent of the rock and roll stars of this generation.
Let's talk about kale. And I just learned this morning that kale might have been kicked off the superfood list. We don't know that or not. but, you know, kale, I would say a generation ago, was not eaten in fancy restaurants, shall we say. And now you can't go to a restaurant now and not have a choice of some kind of kale salad.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, the biggest single purchaser of kale in the country and probably the world was Pizza Hut, who used it to line the bottom of the trays that they served at their all-you-can-eat whatever grease buffet. No, I love Pizza Hut. And I have a soft spot for it. But, that, you know, it was a garnish. It was window dressing, really. And it grew, you know, because of health trends. It was anointed a superfood because it has certain nutritional properties. Which is really a meaningless term. It's like saying it's unicorn food, basically.
Isn't it though loaded with nutrition and things like that?
It is, but the term superfood is, you know, it's a meaningless, an utterly and completely meaningless term. It is
sort of like
a license
natural
for snake oil. Yeah, like natural, but even more. I mean, there's no superfood. The European Union has actually banned the use of the term as basically a form of false advertising. But kale, you know, it had these nutritious properties. It's very high in fiber. It's high in certain nutrients. It is undoubtedly good for you. But it also had a number of different properties that made it uniquely advantageous to anyone who was using it, restaurants or the home cook. I mean, when you think about what kale's replaced, which is largely spinach and sort of baby spinach, you know, when you buy a thing of spinach, what happens after 3 days of it sitting in your fridge? It just wilts and turns to the slime and you have to throw it out. And when you put it in a pan with some heat, it just, you know, disappears down to 10% of what it was. Well, you know, I frequently keep kale in my fridge for 2 weeks or more, forget about it, rediscover it, put it in a bath of water, and all of a sudden it's good to go. It's very hardy. It's sort of you know, as shelf stable as a leafy green gets. And it works in salads and it works in hot dishes as well. And it's kind of this great chameleon. And so for all the hype around kale, the reason why it's sustained itself as a trend and maybe chard hasn't, or collards, let's say, is that, you know, it's just very practical.
What about and I didn't realize that the bacon was a hot, trendy food. I'm not much of a meat eater, but you really point your finger, I guess, at the pork industry, trying to figure out how to get people to salivate for bacon. How did that work?
Well, you know, the trend known as bacon mania, which is really bacon and everything. I mean, Burger King has a bacon, you know, Sunday. So that's the logical conclusion of it. Yes, they do. And
wow.
Denny's has a whole bacon menu that they come out with a couple times a year and people flock to it. But other, you know, high-end chefs, people in the Star Group, for example, you know, they're putting bacon on all sorts of dishes. So bacon really went from being this food that was a breakfast food, you know, bacon and eggs, bacon and sausage, bacon and pancakes, and something that you would find really on club sandwiches and BLTs, to what one person referred to as a condiment. And this happened because, you know, bacon was really just eaten at breakfast and sort of in the summer to go along with tomatoes and BLTs and Cobb salads. But in the 1980s, when the health trend of low fat and low sodium really came into the fore, bacon was demonized. Bacon sales plummeted, and pork bellies, the cut of meat that bacon comes from, dropped in price tremendously. People were giving them away. Farmers were really getting hurt because it's the largest single cut on the hog. And so after a couple of years of these pork farmers just getting beaten up by bacon, they turned to the Pork Industry Marketing Board and they said, listen, you got to help us sell this stuff. And the pork board turned to the fast food chains and the restaurant chains and said, you know, how can we get you to guys use more bacon? And the fast food chain says, listen, we're selling all these low-fat burgers and chicken breast sandwiches that are dry as cardboard. We'd love to have more bacon, but, you know, it's a big, smoky, greasy mess that's costly and really annoying to cook. Find a way to help us cook it easier. And so they developed with, you know, people at Iowa State University and different agricultural schools, a round pre-cooked bacon that restaurant chains could reheat in a convection oven with very little fuss or muss, and that would fit perfectly atop a sandwich to sell for a dollar extra. And people really loved it because it added tremendous flavor and mouthfeel to these dry, low, extra low fat sandwiches. And so the bacon trend started out that way, and it really grew because, you know, listen, if Burger King puts one thing on their menu, the scale of that operation affects the price of the commodity that they're using tremendously. And the other chains, of course, will want to come on board once they see that it sells. But what happened is, as people started eating more bacon in these forms in the early 2000s, chefs were taking notice and saying, hey, you know, maybe I should put bacon on my menu. Maybe we should do a salad with bacon. Maybe we should toss Brussels sprouts with bacon. Maybe I'll do some sort of cool bacon caramel brownie. You know, just a little bit of bacon, but to make it funky.
And that's David Sacks, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We are talking about bacon and kale and his new book called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you could send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen, talking about food trends and fads. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you're just joining us, David Sacks is our guest. We are talking about food fads and trends, the subject of his new book called The Tastemakers. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. David, it is interesting to sort of remember when there weren't coffee shops on every single corner in every single city and town in America, or frankly, even around the world. And you really credit Maxwell House with sort of realizing that at least people want to drink a certain kind of coffee and they want the convenience of coffee as well. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, you know, we think of trends as kind of trickling down organically from chefs or creators, but sometimes within the industry, as we talked about with bacon, you know, a trend can be created by marketing departments.
Right.
The idea of a coffee break is something that was borrowed from Swedish culture. I think it's called a fika, this afternoon sort of coffee and pastry break, which housewives in Wisconsin were sort of doing in North America. And Maxwell House, trying to drum up sales of coffee in the 1950s, I believe, you know, fought to make this and marketed this as something that was culturally relevant. Have a coffee break. Let's have a coffee break with Maxwell House. And it got to the point where, you know, coffee breaks are enshrined in union contracts. They're such a fundamental part of our culture that we don't even think twice about where that trend emerged from. And so now, you know, of course, there's coffee everywhere, coffee on every corner, coffee in every store, coffee in every restaurant. And that coffee break is still a ritual that we indulge in.
I mean, what I notice in the little town that I live in that has a couple of coffee shops is that it creates then this social network and where people after dinner stroll down, get a cup of coffee, bring their laptop and talk with friends. Talk about a cultural shift.
Exactly. And so when we think about trends, you know, food trends passing on, we say, oh, it's no longer relevant. It's no longer something that, you know, it's no longer hot. Well, sometimes the cultural legacy of those trends, like the coffee break, remain with us long after, you know, we talk about coffee breaks, long after once we've moved on from Maxwell House years ago, mm-hmm. most of us have, to Starbucks and other sorts of, you know, single origin fair trade beans. But those rituals and the cultural touchstones stay with us, and they push us to the next iteration of that trend.
What do you make of the farm to table trend that's certainly happening? I'm sure it's happening up in Toronto. It's certainly happening here as well, which is that restaurants join up essentially with farms to get fresh, sometimes organic food delivered on a daily basis. Is that do you see that as sort of here to stay?
I think so. I mean, I think as long as it's within within reason, it will be. You know, it's an interesting example of a food trend that really started as a political ideal. Local food, organic food were movements that have been around for decades, but they were political ideals. It was let's you know, cook or let's use organic produce because it's better for the environment and the soil and pesticide use is bad. Or let's use local produce because we shouldn't burn so much gas shipping stuff in from California and Chile, and we should eat with the seasons. And they were political ideals, and you would, you know, get people in Berkeley, California who wore Birkenstocks talking about them, and it would be these very earnest hippie ideals, and it's like, oh, okay, stop preaching to me. But then what happened in the past decade is that these things became food trends. You would go to the best restaurants in Philadelphia, here in Toronto, in New York, in Los Angeles, London, Tel Aviv, wherever. And this is what those restaurants would do. It was de rigueur that this was the way they would do it. It was no longer acceptable to fly in foie gras from France. And so as that became a food trend, as that became something that this is better tasting food, this is the cool thing that we should do, it was never about, you know, people didn't even think about the ideals behind it. It's just this is the trendy thing. That's when you get this movement and this groundswell of change in public behavior. And it affects the economy of scale around it. And so you have Walmart selling organics or Chipotle talking about the local provenance of their fruit and vegetables.
We have an email from Ed asking about gluten-free trends. And I'm looking at a headline that was in the New York Times just a day or so ago. Gluten-free eating appears to be here to stay. David, what do you make of the gluten-free trend?
It's a very interesting one and a very divisive one. I've you know, encountered a lot of people who have said that, you know, the best thing I got was when I sort of disparaged the rise of so many people who have no real sensitivity to gluten jumping on this as a sort of diet and weight loss bandwagon. I had someone with celiac disease write me and said, please don't ruin this. It's the best thing that's ever happened to the celiac community.
Right.
Because all of a sudden they've gone from like one tiny shelf in a health food store to an entire aisle of, you know, Whole Foods. And for them, it's limitless choice. But, you know, the majority of the people that are eating gluten-free are doing it to lose weight or doing it because it's something that they heard about or they read about and don't necessarily understand. There's certainly a number of people who are, you know, who have celiac disease, who have a serious medical condition, or who have a strong intolerance to wheat products. Maybe it's gluten, maybe it's something else that feels some benefit to this. You know, the current high pitch that it's at and the current adaptation of it as a widespread health and diet trend throughout the population will most likely wane somewhat in the coming years as people move on to other things, as those people who are eating gluten-free to lose weight miss croissants and move back into it and then start, I don't know, you know, avoiding water or something.
Well, and miss those cronuts as well, the hybrid of the donut and the croissant. We have a tweet from Nathan wondering to what degree are low-carb ideas in cooking and lifestyle still trending in food culture, which gets us, I think, into a bit of a discussion about diets and losing weight. And sometimes it's low-carb, sometimes it's fat, fat-free, high-fat, low-fat. What do you make of the what appear to be almost like dueling headlines about how to lose weight?
Yeah, it's just it's a crazy cycle of you know misinformation that just vacillates from one to the next, and the only certainty is their eventual reversal. You know, how many years did we waste eating low-fat chicken breast sandwiches and low-fat cheese and, oh, God, egg white omelets cooked in margarine until finally the research came out and it's like, oh, whoops, we were wrong. Yeah. Sorry about that. We're sorry we deprived you of all that delicious butter and, you know, rib steaks for all those years. Please go ahead and enjoy now until the next study comes out and says that's going to kill you as well. We're you know, somewhat schizophrenic in that, which is really unfortunate. And it does leave a large opening for people to sort of have their fears and misinformation exploited. And so I think of all the health trends, of all the food trends, health and diet trends are really the ones that are the most precarious and dangerous.
And there's something almost like eating disordered about those trends.
Right, exactly. You know, it's the person who is gluten intolerant today is lactose intolerant tomorrow, stops eating carbs, starts eating fat, I mean, it's just from one to another. You know, show me someone who's been on the exact same diet for 35 years and I'll give them some sort of reward.
Let me quickly reintroduce you, David Sacks. David Sacks, our guest on Radio Times today, and he's been writing about business and food. His writings appear regularly in the New York Times, Bloomberg Businessweek, Savour, The Grid, and his new book is called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. His first book, Save the Deli, won a James Beard Award for Writing and Literature. We are talking about food trends, food fads, and again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We have a comment from Dan from Malvern. What are your thoughts, David Sacks, on the anti-GMO sentiments? And this, of course, can get us really deep into the back and forth on GMOs.
You know, I mean, my personal thoughts are I don't really – it's not something that I followed tremendously. But you know, in the context of what we were speaking about, you know, when I was talking about the organic and local trends, again, this is something that is being pitched right now largely as a political thing. You saw the proposition in California last year or 2 years ago to sort of for GMO labeling. It's something that, again, you know, Greenpeace followers and people on college campuses are yelling about, but the majority of the American public doesn't care. But if it becomes a food trend, if the top chefs are saying, we don't use GMO, and this is something that people saying, oh, this is great, it's a GMO-free cronut or my GMO-free gluten bread, eventually, if that sells enough, then large companies like Dole and McDonald's and General Mills are going to say, OK, we can capture more market share with this. Let's move in this direction. OK, we're no longer selling GMO things. I think it was Panera Bread who recently said they weren't going to use artificial ingredients anymore. So again, they're not doing that out of the goodness of their heart or their conscience. They're doing it because they realize it will give them an advantage in the market. And if natural sort of eating is trending, then you know,
there's a market
there. Capture
a
couple points. There's a market there, exactly.
I've noticed in the last year or so on menus the combination of fried chicken and waffles. I haven't ordered it yet. I don't know if that's a Philly thing.
I thought it was. You know, it's, I think it's a largely like Southern African American thing. But I remember watching Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which is where I got most of my Philadelphia culture from.
There you go. You're welcome.
And one of the early episodes, you know, DJ Jazzy Jeff brings in chicken and waffles from Philadelphia to Will Smith. This is a terrible reference. But, you know, it's that is part of, again, you know, a greater trend towards Southern food and soul food that's been happening in the past couple of years, that Americana trend, the comfort food trend. And you see it in all sorts of different ways. You see places like Roscoe's or whatever the – is Roscoe's a Philadelphia restaurant?
I don't
think so.
Or, oh, okay. Yes. L.A. No,
LA.
Apparently
so
not in Philly.
What's the local chicken and waffle chain, if your producer
Ooh,
knows?
Ooh, I don't know. I'm looking at my engineer who's a foodie like me, and when we're shaking our heads, we don't know.
Don't know. Okay.
Don't know.
Well, you know, again, it'll work in the sense of, you know, Guy Fieri visiting a place like that and it becoming really popular and people going on sort of pilgrimages to it. But you'll also find it at high-end restaurants where it's like a little amuse-bouche of chicken and waffle or, you know, a waffle made out of chicken or whatever. These things work their way through the food chain in a lot of different ways. And then you also get the breakfast waffle chicken sandwich, I think, at Taco Bell, where all food trends go to die.
Well, you and I were tweeting back and forth about Scrapple and cheesesteaks. I mean, clearly cheesesteaks are here to stay, and you're welcome, America. You're welcome, the world. Scrapple, I'm not sure so much, which is obviously sort of a local, shall I say, delicacy here, David.
Yeah, although there was a hipster taqueria here in Toronto where a bunch of, you know, tattooed guys and girls in cutoff jean shorts were serving, you know, fancy tacos to really loud hip hop, and you know, one of their first big hits was a Scrapple taco. it's
Whoa.
you do see it. I mean, I have seen it sort of working its way around America quite a lot. And the cheesesteak's a great example. I mean, I think you know, while the roast pork and provolone sandwich hasn't caught on outside Philadelphia as much, you know, Toronto is a couple of years ago was just rife with cheesesteaks. And I remember when I was a kid, I went to camp with some kids from Philadelphia, and you know, they were describing cheesesteaks. This one kid, Andrew Welt, I hope he's listening, was describing cheesesteaks from Philadelphia, and it just sounded like the most heavenly thing. And for years, I was obsessed with it, and I looked for them around Toronto and couldn't find them. Fast forward a couple of years, and you know, you can't walk 30 feet without bumping into a place that serves "quote unquote" Philly cheesesteaks. I don't think it's exactly Pat and Gino's, but you know, it gets the craving right.
Let me get. Looks like Merrill from Medford, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Hi, Merrill. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
I was wondering what your thoughts were on bottled water. If that's a trend, and the reason I'm asking is because my 9-year-old grandson and his contemporaries, they don't seem to know that they could drink water out of the tap.
Very interesting, Merrill. Yeah, go ahead, David.
Yeah, no, that is, you know, I hadn't even thought about bottled water before. That's a great example that I should have put in the book. And it's something like coffee, whereas, you know, in the 1980s when Evian Perrier started coming into the market, that was a trend. It was trendy people in New York and, you know, the mainline. You know, people who had access to gourmet markets that would buy and drink this stuff. And wow, look how wealthy I am. I could drink water out of a bottle and just toss it away. This is the ultimate. And then it became such a huge market and it became so pervasive, and Coke and, you know, all these huge companies got into the game, that today we don't even think about it. We don't even consider it. The economic consequences of it are huge. The ecological consequences of it are huge. I mean, there's, you know, entire islands in the Pacific Ocean made up of plastic bottles. It's terrible what it's done, and there's personal health implications. But again, that is something that's a trend. We don't think of it now as trendy. We may think of one type of water as trendy. Oh, you know, everybody's drinking Iceland water or
Poland,
what was that stuff a couple of years ago? I forget what it was. Voss water, I think, is the new one, the Norwegian one. You know, the entire trend of bottled water has tremendous implications. And as you can, your caller's grandkids noted, I mean, it affects behavior so deeply because it's so repetitive that they don't even know that water comes out of a tap.
Well, and the idea that you can carry water with you wherever you go, I mean, which is, I'm old enough to realize that that's a very revolutionary idea. We have an email from, looks like Leanne, is eating in moderation a trend? That's interesting. An interesting question.
David? It should be. I don't know. Ask my wife. She keeps telling me to slow down.
Oh, is that right?
You know, that's one of those – that's interesting. It's one of those things when we talk about health and diet trends that people know that is, you know, generally the way it should be. When you say, what's the healthiest diet? Eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. You know, don't eat so much – so many cheesesteaks and eat in moderation and exercise. You know, that's boring and it's not sexy. People would rather hear that they should eat a bunch of kale and chia seeds and put them in their Coke and they'll be fine. It ought to be a trend. But if you look at the statistics of health in this country and this continent, unfortunately, it hasn't caught on tremendously yet.
About a minute before our second break here, do you think Canada and the U.S. basically share the same diet, the same approach and views about eating and food?
Pretty much. I mean, there are some subtle differences, you know, in terms of ethnic foods and cultural foods, and in terms of portion sizes. It's still a lot bigger down there.
I mean, it's obviously bigger.
Bigger, yeah, definitely. You know, the average plate at a Denny's in America is, you know, a third or half the size of the plate in Canada.
Oh, really?
Or, sorry, larger, a third of, larger than in Canada.
So you have Denny's in Canada, but just much smaller portions?
I'm using Denny's as an example. I think, when we cross the border to go on vacation or whatever, the average plate at a restaurant is just much bigger.
That's David Sacks. We're talking about his new book about food trends. It's called The Tastemakers, and it's subtitled Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, as I said, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with David Sacks about food trends. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. David, you talk about people eating bone marrow now. I missed that trend. And what is that trend about?
Well, there's a couple names for that trend, the nose to tail trend, or one that that a food writer I know coined lardcore, which I think could be my favorite. and you know, it goes sort of in line with the local seasonal mantra of we shouldn't waste any part of the animal. And it really came out of England in a chef called Fergus Henderson in the sort of mid-1990s with a restaurant he had, and has, you know, since conquered America, where you have first, it was, you know, roast bone marrow in that very classic traditional European way. And then, of course, as the food trend takes hold, it's bone marrow burgers, bone marrow slathered atop steaks, bone marrow butter. I'm sure there's a bone marrow cupcake somewhere.
Sure there is, with a little bacon thrown in as well.
Yeah.
But are we talking about people eating like the whole, I mean, eating like the face of a pig, for instance?
You know, there's a very, very popular restaurant here in Toronto called The Black Hoof. And there's another restaurant in Los Angeles called Animal. And I'm sure there's one in Philadelphia, which I just don't know about, where, you know, they excel and are extremely successful at selling things that a couple of years ago people never would have eaten. You know, hoofs, intestines, blood, brains, just a slaughterhouse of gore, which they make very well. You know, raw cow heart, all these sorts of things. Raw pork, I think the Black Hoof was selling recently here in Toronto. But they're you know, packed nightly. And it's amazing that the same people who are lining up to eat there, if you had told them 5 years ago that I want to serve you, you know, pig's blood ice cream, they would run away with their tail between their legs. But all of a sudden, it becomes trendy. They read about it. They see about it on blogs. They hear Anthony Bourdain talking about it. They hear their friends talking about it. And it's a socially acceptable and desirable thing. And that just pushes everyone in that direction and creates a, you know, permission for them to indulge in it.
I'm curious what you think about something that I heard about recently called Soylent, and it is Soylent Green, exactly. But apparently, it's a shake that is just filled with chemical ingredients, and apparently, if you eat it, according to the guy that created it, you get all the nutrition that you need without any of the bacon and you know all the taste, it seems to me.
All the fun.
All the fun. I mean, do you see this as something that might catch on?
You know, someone asked me also about the trend, quote unquote, of serving insects. There are a couple companies that are doing insect protein bars. There are a couple of chefs. They're putting insects in things. You know, will it be a widespread trend? I would bet against it. Unless, you know, all our livestock are wiped out or become so prohibitively expensive that these are the only options. We don't just eat for fuel, which is why there's food trends and why we just don't eat, you know, Soylent. We eat for pleasure. We eat for socialization. We eat to establish our role in the world and say something about our class and our interests and our culture and our desires. And so until all that is wiped away and we're living in some sort of hellish post-apocalyptic state, I don't think the majority of people are going to switch to, you know, cricket dust or Soylent shakes because it deprives them of all the pleasures around eating. There are certainly people who are going to do it, probably people in the, you know, fitness community and the health community, or just those pleasureless SOBs who get no joy from eating and, you know, whatever. I don't want to dine with them anyways.
Well, I can hear that. Yes. SOB, right?
So will it become a widespread trend that everybody is adopting and we're all going to give up lunch for Soylent? I sure as heck hope not. I really do. I'd much rather have a cheesesteak.
Soylent with bugs for dessert, right? Something like
Soylent
that.
Soylent with bugs for dessert, yeah. Soylent with a cricket chaser. but, you know, you'll see it in certain applications. Maybe the military will have it. Maybe you'll get different flavors of you know, stuff made with Soylent that then tastes like cheeseburgers, and people will have it as diet foods or meal supplements. You know, it's like Ensure or any of those things or Power Bars. Could they replace your entire meal? Yes. But the only people who really do that are people who are like climbing Everest or, you know, stuck in the Arctic for, I don't know, some expedition for like 3 months. The rest of us will go towards real food when we have the opportunity.
Let me get Joel from Mount Airy to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Joel. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. I'd like to ask a guest what insights he might have about the trend of smoothies and juices and the Vitamix and the Nutribullet and things of that nature.
Yeah. First of all, I have the BlendTec, but my wife's family had the Vitamix beforehand. So there's a hot debate of which blender is the best one.
Oh, really?
It's funny, you know, the juicing trend has been around for a long time. I mean, we all remember the Jack LaLanne infomercials where he's, I don't know, pulling like a caravan of elephants with his teeth or something like that at 90. And he talks about how great he is at juicing. And you know, the smooth, it's like the yogurt trend, whereas every decade it comes and reinvents itself. It was the drink orange juice trend. Then it became the, you know, drink smoothie trends. Then smoothies were too fattening for us, so it was juicing. Now it's green juicing. Now it's cold pressed juices. You can't use your Vitamix. The heat of the blade will kill all the beautiful enzymes, and, you know, it's worthless. It's like drinking a Coke, which, again, you know, just comes down to the basics of people wanted to eat their fruit and vegetables without actually having to, you know, chew through an entire bushel of kale in a day. So, you know, every decade you see a new iteration of it. And what happens is, you know, companies like Coca-Cola and PepsiCo see this happening and they, you know, buy up popular companies that are in this space, and then they find ways to make it more marketable and more processed, and it loses its cachet. So someone opens up a newer, more expensive way of doing it, and so on and so forth. So we'll see, you know, every possible iteration of juicing for the next you know, 100 years is just going to keep reinventing itself. You're just going to have to keep buying gadgets for your house.
More
and
more gadgets, exactly.
Yeah.
Joel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. David, we got an email. We received an email from Peg. She said, glad I saved my old Sterno-powered chafing dish. You can heat up lots of different things during our frequent power outages, and that has been a problem here in the United States of America. I don't know if you have those same problems up there in Canada.
Oh, well, then maybe it's time to start stocking up on Soylent. Soylent and shotguns.
Let me get Rick from Warminster to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The question is about branding as it relates to the different trends that come along. As you go to the supermarket, you look at canned food. You're going to see, of course, some kosher food. You're going to see some Oriental food. And I think now there's going to be a trend towards even Muslim-type food.
Sure.
It kind of reflects the demographics of the culture and the population we have here. As that goes along, is there an FDA consideration, or are those things assumed to be correct and edible, you know, as they come through that process?
Well, Rick, and let me just say, I mean, if something is in the supermarket, it's at least, as I understand it, in this country, the FDA has to approve that. So it's just a matter of, I think, just a much more diverse palette of food to choose from. David Sachs?
Yeah, those religious certifications don't affect the way the food is made in terms of, you know, the FDA things. You can have food that is, you know, bad and contaminated that isn't religiously certified. And certainly there are cases where there has been. That's, you know, foodborne illness and pathogens and those things have nothing to do with the religious certification. The certification is basically there to make sure that the manufacturer of that food adheres to the laws regarding such thing as, you know, the inclusion of pork or the mixing in dairy and meat and sort of the cleanliness and the practices of those facilities. But you do see, interestingly, in terms of food trends, you know, more labeling around things that then become mainstream. So gluten-free is a great example. You know, a while ago, it was very hard to find products that were labeled as certified gluten-free. And you know, there is associations now that that's their job to make sure that, you know, products meet a certain standard. And those products with a gluten-free label on it will, you know, open themselves up to a market of people who eat gluten-free. And so a lot of food manufacturers do this, even though the percentage of Muslims or kosher Jews in the United States may be relatively small to the population. You know, you have Oreos that are certified kosher and Cheerios that are certified kosher and halal because they don't want to leave themselves out of that marketplace. And so you'll see the same thing with gluten-free and maybe non-GMO eventually and other things that come along and become trendy to the point where, you know, the food industry and the marketing of it can't ignore it.
Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I thought he was going to raise something like Chipotle. You mentioned that. You know, all of a sudden that's everywhere. Everything is Chipotle now.
Chipotle, Sriracha is sort of the contender to Chipotle. Yes. in the heat category. Those are interesting because those are things that come in really as kind of ethnic cultural trends, a flavor of a specific cuisine, Mexican cuisine or Southeast Asian cuisine. And then they really jump out from that cuisine and find themselves as part of the greater food culture and find themselves in all sorts of things. And so you'll get a Sriracha cheesesteak or, you know, a Chipotle scrapple at the hipster taqueria in Toronto where they actually serve that. There you
really?
Go.
Wow,
So it's interesting to see that. And that's a very North American phenomenon. You know, you don't see that in Europe. I think if anybody was going to cook, spaghetti bolognese with Chipotle in it in Napoli or Bologna, they'd be up in arms about it.
I know that Patagonian toothfish is the real name for Chilean sea bass, but I did not know until I read your book, David Sachs, is that canola oil is really the amalgam of the two words Canadian and oil.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, because originally it was called rapeseed oil. And when the Canadian Rapeseed Farmers Association were looking to promote this as a healthy cooking oil in the 70s, when it was really unknown in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, they said, well, you know, listen, rapeseed is not exactly a buzzword that we want to associate with. And so they came up with this idea, and they rebranded it, which happens a lot with foods, especially in the produce and agricultural world, to something more marketable. And canola oil, I think, is now the second most popular cooking oil in the world after palm oil.
We have saved the best for last, which is the proliferation of food trucks in cities, I'm sure in Toronto, certainly here in Philadelphia. And as you write about it, it's obviously part of a foodie movement, but there has been a sort of a political side to that as well. Can we assume that Toronto has its fair share of good food trucks?
Yeah, I think it's a similar city to Philadelphia in that sense. You know, it hasn't blossomed because of the political obstacles, but there's been a strong movement. And listen, you know, Philadelphia had versions of street food for many years. I remember pretzel vendors there years ago when I visited. And people were always saying, well, why can't we sell more than pretzels and hot dogs? Toronto had hot dog carts. That was what we had. And for years, it just never took off. There were always obstacles. There was always bureaucracy around it. And so in 2008, 2009, when the modern gourmet food trucks started, driven by chefs, really sort of putting experimental, interesting food, came out of Los Angeles, it started spreading virally around the country and the continent very, very quickly. And so in Philadelphia, what you had is a number of entrepreneurs like Dan Petticetti from the Little Dan's Gourmet Food Truck, who does, I think, Italian sandwiches, you know, putting their stakes there and saying, all right, this is something I'm going to do in investing. And when the city came back and said, whoa, 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 you can't park here. Here are your restrictions. You got to move every 10 minutes. You know, you're in the way of restaurants. Because it was a trend and because people in Philadelphia could read about it on blogs and the newspaper and watch about it on the Food Network, Food Truck Wars and the Great Food Truck Race, they would call up their city councilors and they'd say, whoa, 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 hold on. I want this. This is something I want now. And so food trucks, because it became trendy, had the political momentum to suddenly push through legislation that was favorable and allow themselves to establish themselves and really to remain and grow. And I think that's the thing that we don't think about is, you know, food trends have political power. We talked about it with the GMO thing. You know, something may be an issue and it might have all the right reasons for it to go ahead. But until it's a trend that people really love and want, they're not going to raise their voice unless they're married to the issue. But as soon as you say, hey, look, I'm going to restrict what you're eating for lunch, people get up in arms about that. You know, if someone said we're restricting cheesesteaks in Philadelphia
because they're unhealthy,
a revolt. They'd burn down City Hall in a second. And so you saw that with food trucks. And really, it's amazing how the small number of food truck owners were able to leverage the popularity of their trend into political action.
We're almost out of time here. Why do you love food so much? Because it's clear you do.
I have to eat it three times a day.
Well, it has to be more than so do I, but it has to be more than that.
That's a good question. I you know, amazingly, no one's ever asked me that.
It's your life,
yeah.
Isn't it?
I think it's something that we derive so much pleasure from and so much of our culture from, and so many of our best interactions come across the table, going out to get a meal with someone. There's a type of connection that happens over food and around food that you just can't replicate in any other way in life.
That's David Sacks, author of a book called The Tastemakers. He joined us from the CB studios in Toronto and was a guest earlier this year on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program, including how to download podcasts of the show. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can sign up for our newsletter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.